Hey, this is Matthew. Just wanted to jump into this recording and give you some context about this episode. This week's episode, as well as last week's, is part of a mini-series that I'm recording in partnership with Kaylee Jones Books about the craft of writing. So in this mini-series, each episode will be about a specific area of writing, things like writing historical fiction, writing mystery, plot, point of view, etc., etc. This episode you're about to listen to is on writing historical fiction, which is really fast becoming one of the most dominant literary genres in the market. The interview you're about to see or listen to, depending on whether you're on the podcast side or the YouTube side, was conducted over Zoom with Deirdre Sinnott. Deirdre is the author of The Third Mrs. Galway, published by Kaylee Jones Books. I'll put a link to her book in the show notes. And Deirdre is going to share her expertise that she's gained on writing historical fiction, what are her techniques, her process, some of the pitfalls that you might want to avoid or things you'll want to consider while you're writing historical fiction, the research that goes in behind it, what makes it into the book, what doesn't. It was an interesting conversation. Deirdre is an author and activist and historical consultant, actually, for the Fort Stanwix Underground Railroad History Project, which really speaks to the passion that underpins the story of the Third Mrs. Galway. The novel takes place in 1835 in Utica, New York. To quote from the book jacket of this marvelous novel, when Helen Galway discovers a secret, two runaway slaves are hiding in the shack behind her husband's house. Suddenly, she's at the center of not only the era's greatest moral dilemma, but her own as well. Should she be a good wife, quote-unquote, and report the fugitives to her husband, or will she defy convention and come to their aid? Within her home, Helen is haunted by the previous Mrs. Galway, recently deceased but still an oppressive presence. Her husband, injured by a drunken tumble off his horse, is assisted by a doctor of questionable ambitions who keeps a close eye on Helen. In charge of all things domestic is Maggie, formerly enslaved by the Galway family and freed when emancipation came to New York 8 years earlier. At the same time, Utica is at the center of emancipation efforts as abolitionists arrive for the founding meeting of the New York State Anti-Slavery Society. Those who plead for an immediate end to enslavement are attacked by newspapers accusing them of being insurrectionists and traitors to the Constitution. Everyone faces dangerous choices as they navigate this intensely heated personal and political landscape. And that's from the book Jacket of the Third Mrs. Galway. And it really was a fascinating conversation that we had about what is involved when it comes to writing historical fiction. And obviously, the thing that is on the minds of most people who write historical fiction is this question of authenticity, accuracy, but also taking that creative license that we all want to take. And the real power of historical fiction to reveal truths about life that we still live in the present day. So the way it resonates, the way historical fiction resonates, even in the 21st century, is really a fascinating impact that historical fiction can have. Stick around for the end of the conversation. Make sure you see it all the way to the end for the James Lipton-style rapid-fire question and answers to the interviews that I do. You'll get some interesting bonus content there about Deirdre that I found interesting and intriguing. So hope you enjoy the conversation, and without any further ado, I give you Deirdre Sinnott. Dummy like a Hellcat. Hey, and welcome back for another installment of our craft series we're doing in partnership with Kaylee Jones Books. I'm here with Deirdre Sinnott. She's the author of The Third Mrs. Galway. And we're going to talk a little bit about the process of writing historical fiction and the craft of writing historical fiction. Welcome, Deirdre. How are you?
Hi, thanks, Matt. I'm doing really well. I'm glad to be here and glad to participate in what I think would probably be a really good discussion all around from all the authors, because I'm sure nobody gives the same answers to your questions.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there's probably different approaches. So I'm glad to speak to you about this subject, because I know you're quite the researcher, and I think we were one of the first people we thought of
with this process. But with anybody who writes historical fiction, yeah, I think there's probably different approaches. I'm looking forward to hearing what the what your response is as well. And I just want to kick off with that. What is the general approach to writing historical fiction? Do you use history as a sort of a vehicle through to make like a more modern day statement? How do you approach it? Do you say, I want to make something, I want to write about what's happening today in 2022, but through a historical lens? What is the, how does that work for you in terms of writing historical fiction?
Well, I mean, I really like to look at things that I don't know about. When it comes to the third Mrs. Galway, it was something that I had been researching for nonfiction talks for many years before I started writing the novel. But mostly I wanted to talk about this part of history that I never learned about when I was coming up in Utica, New York schools, and that I think is an important part of the history of that area, and that it's just really not talked about or known within the county or the region. And some things are known, but somehow Utica got left out. So there was a certain spirit of competitiveness that got me started with this particular book. But also as I move on to the next book, I'd like to look at things that I didn't understand and suddenly hear about. And then I like to ask myself, well, what are the women doing? And because history has tended to be male-centric, I like to think about the fact that, they weren't doing it alone. They had a whole other system running, and that was based on women's labor, women's minds, and women's actions.
So I'm hearing that for you, maybe historical fiction is a way revisiting stories that have been sort of not told or brushed over as a way of sort of re-earthing some of the things that we don't think about or realize about our history.
Yeah, I mean, I like the deep politics of the stuff that I'm writing about, and that I like the conflicting politics of and trying to sort that out in a human way so that I can talk about it in a way that people will relate to rather than just as politics as politics. How does it affect people's lives from the top to the bottom? And also who is not being portrayed in a lot of fiction or historical fiction? Who's there anyway, but just tossed aside as a minor character to be mentioned because they happen to be there, but not politically important.
Yeah. But what are some hallmarks of credible resources? I think that's one of the things I think anyone sitting down to write historical fiction maybe struggles with, is where to go to find credible resources when you're trying to find primary source material. For example, I think one of the challenges of anyone who's writing historical fiction is, how do I insert myself into the sort of the mentality of the people of a specific time period without being overly cliche? How do I figure out what the zeitgeist is, and does it help to look at maybe court cases or laws? So what are some good resources that you find, generically speaking? And you could also speak specifically to your novel, but just even generically speaking, what are some broad resources that you think are credible and good for people to look at, that as a way of advice to people writing historical fiction?
Well, I mean, the laws are important because they affect people's lives, and that's because the characters, their actions, and their lives are intricately associated with the time period that they're in. So it's important to know who's voices are being silenced, who's being denied what right that we consider now to be just a matter of course, and that kind of thing. So you know what people's struggles are in everyday life. I mean, there's also, I have found that trying to understand money in these periods, the currency, whether it was a single currency in a country or if, like in the United States, as it was developing, every bank had its own currency. And there could be several banks in one town with its own drafts. And that ends up being important because you need to know how people are doing those everyday things like buying a fish or, exchanging goods for services. And also, I love period newspapers. They're talking history at the moment. You know, they're just writing what's going on. And you find out what the big debate is. I had no idea how much abolition versus the colonization, which is sending free people of color to Africa, to Liberia. I didn't know that that was going on at the time in the 1830s. And it absolutely was a central driver of the narrative in the third Mrs. Galway. So if I don't look at those things, I mean, I look at a lot of different other things, but some of those are for tone or for language or for words that were being used in that period that we don't use anymore, which adds color to what I'm doing. And also there's been a lot of research done about some domestic issues. I have a wonderful book about kitchens in the colonial period. And that helped me with the 1830s. You'd know that some things had changed, but some things remained the same.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. So, periodicals, newspaper periodicals, in your local library would have local law books. Those are good places to start.
Usually when I don't immerse myself in law books, but when there's a question like, can women inherit from when their husbands died? Can they own property in their own name? If they have an inheritance from their father, who controls that? What was the condition of enslaved people between 1799 and 1827 in New York State from the passing of the Gradual Emancipation Act to the day July 4th, 1827, when everyone was supposed to be free? What were the particulars of that law? What was covered, what wasn't covered? You know, and it that kind of thing was important for eureka moments within the book. It's like, oh, this particular law could have been violated by a character, which sends everybody out, which has ramifications for the whole story. So there were some things that was essential to know. And then as I was writing, things that was essential to find out.
Ah, great. Is there a lot of pressure to approach a well-worn period in history? I know your novel is unique in certain respects. When you're talking about the role of women, but on the broader theme of slavery, the Civil War, the Holocaust, even there's no shortage of books that cover that time period. And I guess my question is there a lot of pressure? Do you feel pressure to write one of those books from an entirely new perspective? Right? How do you fight off the sense that maybe you're not being original enough, which is sometimes a voice that can get into your head for the worse, not for the better, right? When you're writing something, like, am I being fresh enough? Like, we always think about, are we being fresh with our metaphors and our similes and our writings, are new? What are we doing to make it new? But my question is, when you're talking about a time period, do you worry about that in that sense? Or do you just set out to tell the story you're going to tell, let the chips fall where they may?
I mean, it's hard after the Bible and Shakespeare to do anything original, right? All got done. So you're just reiterating all the essence that those writers put into those two seminal texts, Sure. There's almost nothing new under the sun after them. But of course, we are also in a period where we've come out of a time when most of the writers who were respected, who were published again and again and again, were white men. So any perspective beyond that, you're already in a little bit of original territory, because, you know, there was a feeling, I think, particularly about women's stories, that it's too messy, it's too emotional, there's blood involved, and, you know, you just don't want to get into it. And it's not interesting, because they're not like they're building spaceships or, you know, shooting people or that kind of thing.
Right.
Which, of course, they were doing, but that, you know, that comes later, right? But also, I think that it's, I'm looking for marginalized people. I'm looking for people who were there but not looked at, and what their challenges are, and who is on the losing side of society, and to try to give that sector time in whatever I'm working on, because I think that those stories are, they're there, especially if you're a researcher, even if you're doing fiction or nonfiction, these people are there waiting for their essence to be uncovered in some way. And it's very hard for women. I just did a whole talk on women from Utica and Rome, New York, who were in anti-slavery societies in the 1830s, 40s, 50s. And just finding out some of these women's first names, they were all Mrs. So-and-so. And they didn't even have their own first name listed. So finding that out was hard. Finding when they were born was hard. And then finding what they were doing in a way, in a part, was conjecture. Because it's not, sometimes it's written down by some, but sometimes it's just written by one half of a couple. Say, if you're running an Underground Railroad place in your home, and the husband is characterized in a certain way, but they never talk about all of the things that the wife had to do and all of her own feelings that might be coming in. And I really don't think that these details are something that are of interest only to women, because, you know, there's a lot of men who want to know the full spectrum of humanity, and who are willing to take a look at what the other side of the, I don't want to say that gender's two sides, but that I want to take a look at what women were doing and understanding it as part of the general sweep of history. So, yeah. I'm not worried about being original. It never occurred to me. Now, thank you. I will start worrying about it. But, you know, it's just like, I know that the story that I was writing was waiting to be written.
Right.
And that it was there to be written. And so I wrote it.
Yeah, 100%. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a large, you know, history. If you look at, I always look at it as like a fabric or a quilt, you know, it just has so many facets to it. And there seems like there's a never ending way to sort of mine history for stories that don't get told, and unearth them. You know, I just watched a film last night about the Holocaust that I never thought about. It was about basically to the death fighting that took place in the camps, boxing matches that were arranged. And so it was, fascinating part of the Holocaust history that I never knew about, and I'm 47 years old, right? So I could see how, you know, there's just myriad ways in which you can enter into history and tell a story that hasn't been told.
Well, in your first book, for instance, there was a murder that was well known. It was reported out in the New York area. I mean, when you described your book to me, I said, oh, I remember that.
Right.
And yet there's the story behind the story behind the story. And that's what research gets you and imagination gets you.
Sure. How did you safeguard against, you talked about speech a little bit earlier. How did you safeguard against anachronistic speech? There was an interview you did with Shakor Char, and you mentioned needing to look up words, right, to ensure that they were right for the right parlance of the time period. Were there resources you looked at? Because newspaper articles, what I think would be tend to be more formal. Were there diary entries? What resources did you use to try to capture the language and to make sure that you didn't have words in there that they wouldn't have spoken at that time period?
Well, anytime I found a word that I was like a little bit suspicious of, I would get up and look at the Oxford English Dictionary. Okay. And find whether it, you know, when it came about. And that's, it's nice that I happen to have, my husband, you know, happened to have a copy, so I was able to look at it consistently or come back to it with a list of words that I was worried about. And because I have been writing in a workshop setting, I had other people saying, not so sure about this word. And some of them, yeah, people were using, but they still sounded too modern. So I might take another word. The other thing that I have done as I'm working on the book I'm working on now is use Google's Ngram viewer. That's N as in Nancy, Graham, G-R-A-M. And it, what it does is it, you can set a time period. In my case, it is 1700 to 1800. And look up words or phrases and see if they appear in books. So Google searches all these books, and the hair of the dog that bit you doesn't appear very often, but hair of the dog will appear. Yeah. So, you know, it's just that you can find words and phrases and see how often they occur. And sometimes you get nothing back because the word hadn't been invented yet. So those two, I mean, I also, because I was researching for the third Mrs. Galway, because I was researching quite a bit, I also looked at people's personal papers, if they involved a section of the story, period paintings and drawings and histories, especially older histories and regional histories. And also there's official reports from a period that will give you a lot of feel for the language, because it's not just words, it's also, you know, speech, and that you know, you don't want to sound too modern in what you're saying. It's okay for draft one, but if you know, the more you can put into draft one that's correct, the better off you'll be.
What are the limitations of online research in terms of trying to keep accessing all these? I mean, the internet has been wonderful in terms of being able to quickly research things, not have to leave your house. But is there a percentage or a balance? I would imagine there must be some brick and mortar research that, you know, where you have to sort of walk the space. I know with my novel, I had to do that. I went to the location where the boy was murdered and walked around to get a sense. Like, what are some of the limitations that you find, or do you find any limitations with online research?
Online research is really great. A lot of the books that I was looking at were older books, and many of them are digitized, but you can't depend on it. Sometimes they're just not. I love going to libraries, and I love librarians. They're so helpful, and I will travel for facts. Because I'm also writing nonfiction essays and hopefully longer books about these same periods and things that Third Mrs. Galway was based on, I travel to look at wills and deeds and all of that, journals. Like, I'm reading this one journal and transcribing part of it. Started in 1820s and went to the 1870s. One guy wrote in it like maybe once a week mostly. And that's not been digitized. It's not been transcribed. So you just have to look at it and figure out what the heck he was saying. And you get a lot of details from that. So I don't have a percentage, but quite 50-50 is probably accurate, but it doesn't matter if it's 50-50 or 60-40. I don't think so.
How much research is too much research? Is there a point in your research process where, like, the research starts to act as a procrastination tool? I'm a notorious procrastinator a lot of times. Sometimes I'm working on a historical novel right now, and I can find myself spending hours getting bogged down in the research, and I wonder sometimes, am I doing that just to avoid the writing? So is there a point in that research/writing process where you're doing it too much? How do you ward against that? Or is there such a thing? Is it always going to be helpful?
Well, I mean, sometimes one fact can take a whole day to track down, and that's just the truth of it. And each one of these facts is a stepping stone toward the story and how the characters react. So you just got to get it right. And so, yeah, you have to research. And researching is so much fun because the book, particularly before you even start, because the book is this perfect thing and you're just researching it and you can imagine it in your head. And it's nothing like the sloppy getting there and trying to write it out and write it in a compelling way. So it's a very tantalizing to do research. And certainly I'm sure that I have spent time researching when maybe I could be writing. But I also have a lot of writing goals, a daily goal because I can't work every day on it. But the days that I'm working, I'm trying to get out 4 or 5 pages. And sometimes I plow through and maybe check later, but not too much later on some facts. And I mean, nothing's wasted. So I researched, what a boarding house was like in Utica, and then I don't put a scene in, or I write a scene and then it's taken out because it doesn't serve that arrow taking you from point A, point B to the end. Mm. Well, maybe I'm going to use that some other time. It's not wasted time to me. And because I do really like doing it. There's a lot of aha moments in research and a lot of, oh, nuts. This is not what I imagined. So therefore I must revise my thinking about what's motivating this character or what is going to happen because this happened at a time where everybody knew this was going on when I thought it was a secret or something like that, you know? So.
Yeah. I've heard research used as like a metaphor of the iceberg method of research where, you know, just the tip of the iceberg of your research is maybe what the readers will see, but all that information you researched under the surface is informing your writing as you write. In other words, the research is there for you, not necessarily for the reader. I rather like that as a model. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but.
It does, because if you try to include all the fun details that you found, you are going to stray from those stepping stones that are the story and that maintain the tension within the story. You want to get, you may not know exactly where the ending is, but you don't, if you go on too many, for me, if I go on too many sidetracks, if I go into important, what I found details, for instance, let's talk about my trip through central New Jersey to look at all the towns going across New Jersey that had Underground Railroad stops in them. Mm-hmm. So I had mapped it out. I looked at all that they had that I understood in New Jersey. I made a map. I went over toward, what the hell's the name of? Anyway, a town on the river between Philadelphia and New Jersey, right? And then going all the way across, looked at every single town, took pictures, had little stories in my head about what would have happened. And instead of all of that, there's one reference to one town and somebody running to the next town. So, you know, there was a lot there that it was fun to find out and hang out outside and look at things. But, you know, it didn't make it into the story because it would have been too much.
Gotcha. Yeah. When you're reading, in terms of reading historical novels, what makes a historical novel a compelling and original for you? Is it the period in history? Is it the point of view? Or how the author recreates the world? What is it that draws you into an historical novel when you're reading one?
Well, first off, you have to trust that the person who wrote it has researched well enough so that world is created and sort of becomes, you get it in your bloodstream, and that you don't have to worry about whether they have that this fact or that fact, you know, that you can trust them. They've done the research. Now it's just about what all contemporary novels are about, which is story and character. So I think that that's part of it. I think that I want to be immersed in a different culture, different time, And but then most important is the reason why historical novels and science fiction novels and stuff like that work are because they put you into a time and place, and then that time and place becomes the norm of that story. And then it's the compelling characters, it's the tension, it's the challenges that the characters have to overcome, just like any contemporary novel.
We're gonna start to run out of time here, so I'm gonna ask you some rapid fire questions if you don't mind.
Okay, I'll try.
I won't even provide any commentary. I'm going to ask the question, and then you can just give me the answer. I'll move on to the next question. What's the best piece of writing advice you ever got?
Well, to keep writing.
What's the worst piece of writing advice you ever got?
That I needed to know how to spell and about commas and periods.
What genre do you have no interest in writing?
I don't know. No, there's got to be one. I don't think I'm going to do bondage and discipline fiction.
Biggest killer of your writing time?
It's probably checking my email.
What is one item on your bucket list?
I want to get to Egypt.
Very good. And what is the one thing about the publishing world we're not talking about, but we should be?
I think it's about how many publishers, not all, put the book out and just expect the writer to do all the other parts of promotion. Mm-hmm. I think it doesn't seem like a great model to me in that way.
Yeah, this seems like there needs to be more of a partnership between promotion, right? Between publisher and writer.
Right. That's not including Kaylee Jones books or Akashic books. Yeah, but I'm talking about the big people who just have the resources and whatever. The people are still on their own.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it. I'm interested in it, and we look forward to speaking to you again. I'd love to actually talk to you again about any other subject. It's always fun.
Yeah, let's talk about my new novel set in 1777, The Loyalist's Wife.
Oh, wonderful. As soon as you're ready to talk about it.
Let me write it, then I'll be ready to talk about it.
Yeah, that's what I figured. That's your work in progress. Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
All right, take care.